For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The following is a Hoop Bowl presentation.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to episode 13 of the official Pelicans podcast of HoopBall.com. We're providing in-flight insight for all Pella fans. I'm your host, Nick Garisco, and I'm here with Pelicans expert Michael Pelichet, who you can find on Twitter at Mike_Pelicans. I'm at Fantasy Law Guy. As always, feel free to engage with us on social media and definitely help support our pod by subscribing and rating us on your preferred podcast provider. Today's episode projects to be great, but we're going to have to tip off with some news that is not so great, and that is Zion Williamson. Reports indicate that Zion Williamson will be sidelined for even longer than expected. The Pelicans rookie has missed a quarter of the season while he recovers from a torn meniscus that he suffered during the preseason. And he was initially slated to be out for the first 6 to 8 weeks of the season. But now the Pelicans have come out and said that they're being overly cautious and that they're waiting for him to hit certain metrics in terms of his conditioning and recovery before he's allowed to return. And then furthermore, on top of that, David Griffin said that Zion Williamson is very unlikely to play in back-to-back games when he returns to action. So he was expected to return in mid-December initially. That was the timetable. Now it's looking like the best case is early January. Pelichet, what's your thoughts on all this?
So it's just interesting to me because my understanding, I actually wrote an article yesterday as a little just blurb that I put on Twitter, sort of just a screenshot. And some of the points that that I made David Griffin addressed on TV, I don't know if any of those were mine.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if any of those were mine. I don't know if he's just responding to, because this is not just me talking about this, but my argument is this. Okay, so and I want to get into an argument with you about it, because I know you had a difference of opinion, and I think it's going to be a good conversation. So my thought is this. Okay, so if they said 6 to 8 weeks, and suddenly something changed to where whatever it is, if he's not in basketball shape, if he's not in whatever sort of like kinetic movements that he needs to be doing, he's not doing the exact right way, whatever it is, if that's outside of their timetable, then I don't see how that could be considered anything but a setback. Before we get into sort of talking about this, I want to say that I think they're handling it right. And I'm not, this is not meant to be an accusation or anything. I think it's just, it's not going as quickly as they would have planned. But they're not wanting to call it a setback. So I want to get your opinion on it, because you're a way better arguer than I am, and you also disagree with me on Twitter. So I want to hear what you have to say.
I do disagree with the term setback. But first of all, the piece that you wrote was actually the best thing out there. And as I've already plugged you already on this show, at Mike_Pelicans, for anyone who wants to go read that post, it's the best post on this entire situation, because I think it goes into a lot of detail about looking at it from multiple different angles. And you're right to say you don't want to accuse the Pelicans of doing anything really wrong. I mean, they're playing the situation the way that we expect it to. But yeah, I did have two issues with the post. The first issue is that I did agree with Schmidt, who made the original comment. I did agree that it is not a setback merely because he's not hitting his timetable. I see setback as more of a medical term, kind of implying that there was either a re-injury of some type or some type of complication that caused him not to hit his timeline. I don't see it as, you know, it's just taking, for in this case, it sounds like he's just taking a slower time than expected to recover. I don't really see that as a setback, because I see the word setback as more of something literal that actually sets him back, like an actual event that sets him back.
See, the way I see it is we're literally setting a timeline back, right? So like that's the way that
I focus on the time.
Exactly. And I think that's maybe we might be agreeing, damn it, because I was actually really excited about arguing with you. But I would say that I think that, look, first of all, this season where we've lost seven in a row, we don't need to be rushing Zion back. And I don't care if it takes 12 weeks to get him right. The only thing that I'd be worried about in that case is, okay, maybe it's going to be a more serious injury than we thought it would be. But I want them to be conservative. I don't see any problem with any of the things that they're doing here. And I think, and I said this in the article, and I really do believe it, there's a balance, right? Zion is a player who attracts media attention in a way that no Pelican ever has, including Davis. So with that in mind, every single thing, there's already been narratives about his weight, about his ability to stay healthy. People love to go way off the rails with those kind of conversations. So true. With that in mind...
And this isn't helping.
No, it's not helping. But I also think if the Pelicans aren't necessarily giving us all of the information as it's happening, if they're delaying it or trying to control the message, I don't see it as them being dishonest with us. I see it as them prioritizing protecting Zion over what they disclose to the fans. And I think that's the right move, because Zion is way more important than fans being upset for two extra weeks or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the way that I'm looking at this.
Right. And I have no issues with the Pelicans being cautious. The two parts that I disagree on were terminology that you used. The first one was setback, and the second one was the word surprise. I didn't like the idea that it was surprising news. And this is the part, I mean, you said maybe we end up agreeing, but I think we'll disagree on this part. The surprising, there is no surprise here. This news is not surprising. No one should be surprised by this news, because the timetables that they give in these types of situations are almost always extremely optimistic. I mean, I'm a huge injury pessimist, as you know, as probably the audience knows by now. And I've played in fantasy sports and research for years. And I know by now that when a player is given a 6 to 8 week timetable to return, especially a knee injury, I'm going to expect him to return in about 9 to 10 weeks. Like that's at the earliest to me.
I think it's different in football, though. I think you're referencing
that's
football.
True.
I mean, are you? I mean, because that's
fine.
Yeah.
No, I'm not actually. Oh, I mean, I am for the most part, but the fantasy basketball examples are plentiful as well. And the issue is that I get surprised. The thing is that I get surprised when a player actually beats his expected timetable. To me, that's a surprise. It's never really a surprise when somebody doesn't beat it. And the reason is because I think that these timetables to recover aren't accurate kind of by design, actually. I kind of go a little further into it. I think that there are plenty of reasons that these timetables are almost always optimistic. I think first, the team is likely just using timetables given from health professionals, right? I think that if you ask a doctor, hey, you know, what's the recovery time for like a standard torn meniscus? They'll probably say, most doctors would probably agree, hey, that's like 6 to 8 weeks, just like they did here. But recovery time is different than being 100%. And recovery from an injury just means that you're healthy enough to, you know, to go work and use the injured part of your body like you did prior to the injury. For example, like, you know, you're 6 to 8 weeks after your torn meniscus, if everything goes cool, you'll be able to jump and run and lift weights on it, etc. But the timeline's different though, because these are professional athletes. The demand on the body makes an entirely different standard and stress on the knee. The standard recovery time tells you that the knee will be better, but it doesn't take into account when your knee will be ready to play 36 minutes a game on back-to-backs. And it also doesn't take into account that you're going to be in basketball shape after not playing basketball or not even running for the last few months. And it certainly doesn't take into account the mental hurdles that you have to get past by using the knee and forgetting there's an issue. And you've mentioned it already, Michael. It definitely, you know, or you implied it already, it definitely doesn't take into account that Zion Williamson is a star and whether the team's kind of rebuilding or young and wants to be patient or cautious with their franchise-changing number one pick. All of these factors don't go into the analysis of your general 6 to 8 week timeline for a torn meniscus.
But I disagree. I don't see like where is that assumption coming from? You know what I'm saying? I think that they do consider that. Why like what else would that time frame be for? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't care if Zion can run on a treadmill in 6 to 8 weeks. You know what I'm saying? It's about when they think.
I know you don't care.
But
I know you don't care, but fans, other fans do. And I guess I'm trying to imply that there's so many other factors that it's not just about being healthy. It's about actually, you know, I just think there's a difference between being healthy enough and being 100%.
Oh, of course.
Like,
yeah.
And I don't think 6 to 8 weeks for any professional athlete with a torn meniscus, they're going to be 100%. I just don't. I don't think that for any timeline that they give, because historically it just – I mean, this is almost always the case. These players aren't coming back before their timelines. Like, it's very rare. It happens, but it's very rare that a player beats their timeline.
I don't think in basketball that it's that rare. I would say for the Pelicans, given the way that they've controlled messages over the last X years, that it would be. So in that way, I would agree with you that you should be pessimistic about the timeline. But this is also a new regime, and part of their goal was to be different in how they handled things from a media perspective, right? That's part of the reason that Griffin came aboard, is they wanted someone who was going to be able to do that. All right. So let's go with your theory then. So let's say that it is a 6 to 8 week thing, but they don't necessarily mean that. Then the Pelicans took time. I want to say they actually took time to say the timetable. So this was a deliberate thing, right? So let's establish that. So if that was deliberate and they did say that, then what would the advantage be for them with Zion in this particular case of them being aggressive in their estimate? Is it to avoid the immediate speculation that it is a serious injury and to avoid that for at least 5 or 6 weeks? I mean, what is the purpose of it if it was intentional?
You hit the nail on the head with my first reason. That's exactly what I was going to say, probably almost in those exact same words. Zion is such a media spectacle here, and he has so much of a spotlight in New Orleans, like you've mentioned, that yes, you want to first come out and try not to destroy everybody's hopes and dreams, right? And like to dispel the notion that this is any type of situation that has to do with his weight or that it's going, you know, that he's going to be a bust. I mean, you're trying to silence those types of extreme doubters out there. I'm talking about the doubters who are even more extreme than I am. You know, I'm an injury pessimist, but that doesn't mean, you know, once he tears his meniscus, I'm sitting here, oh, he'll never be the same. No, that's ridiculous. But there are people out there who actually think that. We've talked about them, right? So that's the first thing, okay? And the second thing is these teams actually, I know you probably don't want to think like this because you're such a more kind-hearted person than I am, and you don't have these evil intentions like I do.
Well, but evil, you have to remember. All right, let's take a step back. You don't have evil intentions.
All right, I'm not evil, but I'm always seeing, I should say, the darker side of both sides of people, and I should say that you should remember that these teams definitely have an incentive to be optimistic at the beginning of these injury timelines. Why? Because of money. They want people going to the games. They want people to keep buying season tickets. They want people to keep the faith. At the end of the day, this is an entertainment business too, as well as a sports business. And no team is going to just come out and say at the time of the injury, well, the doctor said it's 6 to 8 weeks until he's moving the knee, but, you know, it's probably more like 10 to 12 weeks, so our season's basically over, right? You know, and it's not just the fans either, although they're spending the money. It's also the team, right? It's the players. You want the fans – I mean, sorry, you want the players thinking optimistically for morale purposes, because their outlook on the season is going to be a lot different if you say your star player is missing 6 weeks as opposed to – or how many games is that? Let's just say it's 15 to 20 – or 20 games, let's say, as opposed to half the season, you know, 42 games – or 41 games. That's an entirely different outlook, especially when you're like the Pelicans and you started losing games. So to me, there is an incentive, or there's multiple incentives, to actually want to be aggressive with the, or optimistic with these timelines.
Yeah, and what I would say is, so I disagree with one of your points at the end, but I forgot what it was. But I did agree that it, to me, in more words than that, you were saying that they basically lacked full transparency for a reason, or that they weren't fully transparent with everything because they have business interests, which I agree with. And what really bothers me about all of this is that the team is acting in its own interest. And obviously the fans have a right, season ticket holders, people who are buying tickets for individual games, they have a right to information. But this whole idea of, I don't know, I think they're all self-interested parties. And I don't think that means selfish.
Are you trying to get into a rest conversation here?
No, I'm really not. But I think everything in the NBA, I think fans have these crazy expectations for what they should be told. And I don't think that they're necessarily fair. And I also don't think sometimes, like, I think the push and pull is actually a desirable thing. I think that's where you find some sort of reasonable medium for how much do you disclose and how much do you hold back. And I don't blame anybody in this. And I don't mean to sound as if I don't want to criticize anybody. I just, all of this stuff, man, if Zion comes back in 10 weeks, let's just pretend, rather than 6 to 8, who cares? Are we going to be sitting here 7 years from now saying, man, you know what? Zion's had a great career, but he really missed those 2 weeks in December in his rookie year.
Well, in the long run, people don't care. Exactly. But in the short term, they do. This season mattered to people going in.
I agree, but I think the best interest of the fans, even the ones who might be upset, is a long-term thing. I mean, there are all kinds of studies about how pushing back gratification, the people who can do that are more successful, right? And that's not necessarily exactly what we're talking about here, but in terms of, I mean, who cares if people are upset for 2 weeks? I'm sorry, I'm a fan to some extent too, and I look, you got to do what's right for Zion, and what's right for Zion is unequivocally what is right for our franchise. So, long term. So, I don't care. I don't care about 2 weeks here and there. I mean, I'm watching these games, and we'll obviously get into this more in the podcast. It's pretty tough. Like, this is a hard team to watch right now. They've lost 7 Definitely. Straight. But at the same time, you have to keep the bigger picture in mind here. And I think that's the problem, is that all of us had such big expectations. I will say this, and I'm really not trying to go back to this in my own horn, but I said, like, in the middle of the summer, we even talked about this, right? I said, you can't, of course, it's easy to be excited now. Nothing's gone wrong yet. I mean, and Griffin, I still think, has done a very good job here. But all of this sort of excitement as if everything is perfect and whatever, inevitably things were going to happen. And I think the problem is when you get unreasonably excited at the front end of this stuff, it just leads to this ridiculous crash when expectations don't meet reality. And
so, speaking, oh yeah, go
no,
ahead.
No, I think that's a good transition, because I always forgot what I was going to say anyway. So,
great. Well, no, I want to piggyback off that, because speaking of unrealistic expectations, you're trying to place blame, or you're trying to figure out who you should place the blame on, and then your conclusion basically is that, you know, nobody's really at fault here. It's not Zion's fault that he arguably, I mean, I don't think he suffered a setback, but it's going slower than expected. It's not Zion's fault. It's probably not the trainer's fault. I don't think it's I've already established that. I don't think it's the doctor's fault for, I don't think they misdiagnosed him. I just think that it doesn't take a lot of things into account, and people should be looking more on the back end of those timetables, or even if you're like me, even extending 2 weeks beyond those. That's kind of my rule of thumb, is that they give me a 6 to 8 week timetable. I'm like, okay, I'll expect him back in the game, you know, healthy, in the game, playing normal minutes in about 10 weeks, you know, if they give me 6 to 8 weeks. But if you're a sports fan and you want to place blame on somebody, I'm going to go ahead and place the blame on the common fan. I mean, I'm not afraid to do that. I think if you're a sports fan, or especially if you play fantasy sports and you're optimistic about these injuries and you kind of don't assume the worst, then I think you're bound to get burned, like you're just talking about. I think that you're bound to be disappointed. And you were kind of speaking on the Pelicans' expectations in general going into the season, and you're correct. I'm still talking about this injury optimism stuff, because I think that if you hear the word 6 to 8 time, like, and you think it's going to be 5 to 6 weeks, then you're going to just be like way more often than not. Like, I would even venture, I don't have any studies, but I venture to say like 90% of the time, you're going to be very disappointed with that. And you're going to be one of the more, you know, unfortunate for you, if you're a competitive sports fan, you play fantasy sports, you're going to be one of those fantasy managers who are drafting like AJ Green in this August, when the Bengals said it's going to be a 4 to 6 week injury. And guess what? It's week 14 and he hasn't taken the field yet. And there's been no reported setbacks. So there are countless examples of this every year. I know I went back to football here, but it happens in basketball too. But I mean, we even saw some people with like Kevin Durant and Yusuf Nurkic saying that like, oh yeah, they're going to play towards the end of the season. No, they probably aren't. They probably aren't going to suit up. Nurkic had an initial timetable of, I think it was supposed to be like late January, February. He's not going to suit up in February. I mean, you can come back and quote me on it. I don't care. The chances of him suiting up in February are very slim. I don't care if they said it's February. This is a massive broken leg this guy's coming through. And the Blazers, you know, are not that great. There's so many different variables to come in. And it's just another example of a timetable not being, you know, you need to take the latter end. And all these people, it frustrates me, because all these people, you know, especially these fantasy experts even, are like, oh man, this is so unlucky. He was supposed to come back and, you know, come on. I, and they're like, how was I supposed to know he was going to miss the whole year? You know, I'm so unlucky. No, you weren't unlucky. You were just kind of blissfully ignorant. You know, you were just kind of blindly optimistic, I guess is what I should say. And I said on this podcast, and again, I won't try to toot my own horn here, but this is obviously something I'm very passionate about, this injury pessimism stuff. And I said on this podcast multiple times that I'm not expecting Dion back in December. Everyone's saying he's coming back in December, but I'm not expecting it back. I'm expecting January 1st. That was the date I keep using. And I might even be too optimistic with that now. I mean, I hate to be right about this kind of thing, but that January 1st, my prediction is actually, you know, too optimistic. I don't think he's going to be back January 1st. I think he's going to be back, yeah, mid-January, maybe. I would even push him, now that they've said this, by the time he's actually playing healthy, like normal minutes this season, I'm guessing February at the earliest.
So it's funny, because in the middle of saying that, I was looking up Nurkic's thing, because it's funny. You were saying it, and I was thinking how you're biased because you have Whiteside on fantasy, and I've been waiting for him to – I've been waiting for Nurkic to come back because that would kill his value. And I just looked up Nurkic news, and it just ties in well. So – Blazers GM Nick Olshey said Monday the team will be purposefully vague when discussing Nurkic's rehab, and that's it.
That's really funny.
Okay, it's fair enough.
And it's one of the reasons that I was high on Whiteside. I know he's not like a great real NBA player. I mean,
I cannot watch him.
But you know, that's a whole nother discussion about fantasy stats being different than what. He's an annoyance to watch by any person who respects the actual game of basketball. But one of the reasons I was honestly so high on, or higher than experts, I should say, fantasy basketball experts on Whiteside, is simply because all the experts were just expecting Nurkic to come back. And I'm like, no, why? Because they said he might come back in January, February. The guy broke his leg. No, I don't see it. I'm at least adding a month to that timeline. I considered he might be back in March. But if the Blazers are terrible, which they didn't expect to be, I will grant them that. But, like, you know, it could have been expected that they were going to hold him out, like, until the playoffs at least, you know, right, if they were going to be good this year.
So I will disagree with you on Zion. I don't think – what was the thing you said he's going to be back playing meaningful minutes when?
No, not meaningful minutes. I'm sure he'll get some minutes in January. I don't think he's going to be playing his normal allotted minutes, like, and even back, like, it's like if he never got hurt, I should say. So, like, if he never had the injury, is he going to be back to 100% playing? And that means playing back-to-backs. That means all that stuff. Like, is if he never had the injury, I don't think that's going to be happening until February. And in terms of the back-to-back thing, I don't know if that's going to happen all season now, especially if the Pelicans keep losing like they are.
I don't think he's playing back-to-backs. I think that you're correct with that. I think he'll probably come back in at the – I actually think he'll be back at the end of this month or early January, but I think he'll be playing maybe 20 minutes a night or something like that. I don't think he's going to be playing.
Oh, yeah, they'll definitely
ease him into playing, it. They're definitely not playing him 36 minutes a night to start or anything near that. I would guess around 20 to 24 or something like that.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're playing fantasy sports, like that has to go into your equation too. Like that's another reason why people are so wrong to be injury optimists. Because like even when they come back, even when he steps on the court, you're not getting like the production that you expected because he's gonna especially in the NBA. This happens way more often in the NBA than the NFL. But minutes limits, right? I mean, these guys play minutes limits for like a week or two before they even get back to their normal amount of allotted minutes. They're like on a restriction or whatever.
Yeah, I agree. All right, well, I got nothing else to say about that, so are you ready?
Yeah, I got nothing else to say either. It sounds like I'm just angry at the fans who expected a lot of this. But honestly, no, but in terms of the Pelicans, I just want to reiterate that, look, they're doing the right thing. It's not anyone's fault, and I would honestly just argue that it's probably if you honestly thought he was going to come back in 6 weeks, then it's probably your fault for having unrealistic expectations. And don't give me the part that, oh, that's what they said. Like I've explained, it's not about what they say. It's about just history and everything like that. Let's not get into it anymore. Let's move on to the huge game that the Pelicans played against the Phoenix Suns. And that was probably one of the more – is it fair to say it was one of the most exciting games of the year?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not a high bar to clear, but, I mean, yeah, I would say so.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, it was a fun game. Well, it was a fun game.
Yeah, we've had a couple of overtime – I think three overtime games this year. But this one was particularly fun because the Pelicans were – although we were without Derek Favors again – we were trailing by – what were we trailing by in the third quarter? I think 22 was what we were trailing by at its peak. And we just had this great fourth quarter come back to force overtime. We did come away with a loss, of course. But I think the Pelicans deserve a ton of credit for making the comeback. And it was really fun. It was exciting, especially for the fans who were there. And it was awesome to see the players play so hard while down and fighting until the end of regulation, not bowing down for,
don't use that
slogan. But the fans responded too, right? Like they were there and they wanted that comeback and they were really pulling for it. But the fact of the matter, they once again could not close out the game. So, Michael, what did you think of the finish of the game, and what did you think of the comeback?
All right. This is where I like comebacks. Comebacks are fun. I think the end result is – it's not like the end is all that matters, but I don't put any more important – let me take a step back. I thought this was a moment where there's a real opportunity for some momentum. And I mean in the season, not in the individual game, because you could tell they really wanted that comeback. And
yes,
it really sucks because at the end of all this, Brandon Ingram had a chance to win the game. It was a reasonably good shot. He didn't make it, and the Pelicans lost. And I'm not calling on Ingram. What I'm trying to say here is that what sucks about it is that if that shot had gone in, the story that people will be saying is so much different from the story that they're probably saying today. I haven't been on Twitter a whole lot today.
It had the feel that it was going to be a potential season changer. Not like okay, yeah, if we would have won this game, we would have made the playoff. No, but it had the feel that it could have turned some things around, like mentality-wise, you know?
I agree, and that's what kind of sucked about it, because I thought the comeback was really good. It's not ideal that we let them go up by 20 in the third quarter, especially when I felt like that was a game we really could have won. And I don't think they match up particularly well. I will say this. I want to shout out Kelly Oubre. That guy is a monster. And he's not an amazing player or anything like that. So I guess I should probably take a step back. I thought Kelly Oubre, something about watching that guy play, I just really, really like. I think he's just gritty. And I don't. Man,
it's just both sides of the ball. I mean, he's such tenacious. A good defensive player. I mean, yeah, he is fun to watch, and he's very underrated. A lot of people don't really even know much about him or who he is, And yeah, very underrated player. Obviously, Booker had a fantastic game as well. And he was, I don't want to say he was cold coming into the game, but he, I would say his usage was a little down, and he wasn't, you know, putting up the, at least in terms of points, which is mainly what he's known for, wasn't putting up the points that he normally does. What's one of the reasons that you think Booker was able to get hot in this game?
I think he's just someone who, if Booker goes off, there really is not a lot you can do to stop him. I mean, there are certainly times during that game, and I wasn't watching Booker exclusively, but when I was, there are a few times that I keyed in on Drew on him, and they were just doing whatever they could when Drew was on Booker to get Drew off of Booker. So setting whatever screen they had to just to get another matchup, because that Drew is the person that he is on defense. I mean, it's hard to say that when Booker scored 44. I can't remember exactly how long Drew was on him, but to be frank, I think that when Booker's hot, you're not stopping him. And that's the kind of player he is, because he's a shot maker. Like, I try to differentiate between different types of scorers. And I think you can do things to limit some guys. And then some guys, even if they're not, let's just pretend Booker's the 10th best scorer in the league. I'm just throwing a number out there. There might be people who are better scorers than him who you can stop more than Booker when he gets hot. There's some people, when they get hot, you just cannot defend him. And I think Booker's kind of one of those. I mean, Booker scored 70-something points a few years ago, and that was before he was actually that great of a player. Booker just knows how to score, and if Booker's got it going on a given night, I just don't think there's much you can do unless you have a couple guys. Because even if you have someone like Drew, who is at any given moment defending him well, with screens, that's what you can do. Is even if you can navigate screens extremely well, I think there's so many things that you can do to get the guy that you don't want defending Booker off of him. And so
he was playing point guard a lot last night too. I don't know if that really affected anything, but he was, whenever Rubio was out, I mean, they were usually looking to him as the point guard.
Yeah, and I think where we lost the game, I mean, and I don't know. Defense is just terrible. It's not good. And it's a very simplistic take. It really is. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that our defense sucks. It's just hard, man.
Just look at the final score of the game.
I mean, but like, even with the score though, like, you're looking at plus overtime and the fact that we run a higher pace. I mean, it's going to be inflated somewhat. I mean, even if it's not 139 points, it might be 120 or whatever. It's still a lot.
No matter
it's going to be a lot.
Stat, no matter what stat or metric you look at, our defense is one of the worst in the leagues. I mean, pretty much all categories. Correct me if I'm wrong.
It's pretty bad. It's
been abysmal.
And I think it's gotten better. I actually graphed it yesterday or the day before, and I think it's got... Wait, hold on. Actually, I think it might be getting worse. Like, I have to go back and see it. But, I mean, I think one of the things that bothered me the most, and this is partially because we don't have Favors in there, but, man, like, we cannot get a defensive rebound when we need one to save our freaking lives. It's ridiculous. Like, we had... It was some point at the end of that game, the fourth quarter, where I want to say they got three shots or four shots in the same possession because we couldn't rebound the damn ball.
Oubre. Yeah. I mean, you should not let the opposing team small forward have 14 or 15 rebounds or whatever he ended up having. And Derek Favors being out, of course, but they were missing Aaron Baines and obviously DeAndre Ayton as well for the suspension. So both teams were missing front court pieces. But here's the question I want to hone in on, because I think so many Pella fans are wondering out there, like, Michael, what do you think? This is a recurring theme, right? This not being able to close at the end of games, and we've attributed it to youth, we've attributed it to injuries, blah, 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 of course. But this is the theme, other than injuries, this is the theme of the season, is not being able to close out late games. Now, we had a great fourth quarter, no taking away from that. But again, when it mattered most, we weren't able to come away with the win. Here's my question. What is something that you think the Pelicans need to do differently? Or what's something that they are not really particularly executing on late in the fourth?
I hate this kind of analysis. I hate talking about clutch stuff, because in reality, winning has a lot more to do with the other three quarters than it does with the clutch time.
We shouldn't have let him go up 22.
Right.
But it is a recurring theme. Forgive me for asking.
No, it's not a problem. And I think we were having this conversation in the group chat yesterday, and I I mean this when I say it. I really don't think we have – I think Ingram is the closest thing we have to someone that I trust to close games. But I don't necessarily trust Ingram to close games while still incorporating his teammates. And I'm not saying he's selfish. I think Ingram's been great this year. I'm really excited about him in the future. I don't think Drew is that guy. I don't – they're just the way that he makes decisions at the end of the game, I just don't think is the way that you want someone – to close games. And I don't mean that to say that every single team has that, but I think they're okay. I hate taking this on a tangent again, but I think there are certain players who are really smart and overthink things. I think that Drew is one of those players. I think there are certain players that they might be very instinctive and see the game very quickly and well that way, but maybe aren't as smart as the players like Drew. And I think those are the kind of players to some extent that I want making decisions at the end of the game. And I know that sounds kind of weird to say, but I think you need someone who just has some sort of irrational confidence in himself to a degree that almost seems unhealthy. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. That's from the offensive end. What can we do on defense to prevent these to prevent losing when it counts? What are teams doing offensively in the winding moments of the game that we can't really stop, that we're making all these mistakes that are showing up in the loss column?
I think we're making the same mistakes that we're making all game. I mean, I think one of the biggest things is that we can't rebound worth anything. Jackson, no, and I mean that. It's not like it's not just a scheme thing, right? So, I mean, there's a balance there. So let's just pretend there's a scale of 100%. You don't care about the rebound at all. You just don't want to let them get a good shot, right? And the other end is, okay, no matter where they shoot, we better get this rebound. There has to be somewhere in the middle that you try to get to, right? I mean, they can't be one or the other. It doesn't help you if they could miss 30 shots, and that's great. If you don't get a single rebound, that doesn't help you very much. And on the other end of it, if you just, you know, if you're not over, not aggressive, but if you're not aggressive enough on the perimeter contesting shots or something because you're so focused on getting the rebound, then you might allow them to have better shots than they should. So the rebounding to me is the biggest thing, and I think a lot of it's personnel. I mean, so Favors is a very good defensive rebounder. Jackson Hayes is not a very good defensive rebounder. I love Jackson long term. Right now, he's just not there.
He had one defensive rebound in last night's game. He had a couple offensive rebounds, one defensive rebound, and he played a boatload of minutes.
Yeah,
too.
And I don't mean to. It's not. He played through 32. It says 32.8 minutes is the thing that I'm looking at right now. So that's crazy. I mean, and I think part of it, too, is, again, it's positional, too, right? So, I mean, if Jackson Hayes is in a pick and roll, defending a pick and roll, and he has to step out to the perimeter, let's just say someone like Booker's got the ball, then that means that he's probably not getting the rebound if Booker's shooting that ball, if he gets switched on to Booker or whatever it is. So it can't just be as simple as saying he's not getting rebounds. But I think collectively, I mean, we've had rebounding issues all season. I think they've addressed some of it by changing how they defend when they're on pick and roll coverages. They're dropping the big back more and allowing him to be closer to the rim. But even then, I mean, rebounding is just, it's just an issue. And it's so funny. It's like everybody's brain just has a brain fart at the exact same time. Cause as soon as the ball goes up, everybody's just standing there. And that's something, I mean, it's not just coaching to me. Cause I think it's a lot of it is awareness and the ability to simultaneously remember, okay, the shot's going up. I don't know if that's even simultaneous. The shot's going up. I need to box someone out. I need to put a body on a body. And that's where... Yeah.
I was getting frustrated with Lonzo, actually, not in the Suns game, but in the Mavs game, the game before that. I was getting frustrated. That was the game where Lonzo actually shot 12. I think he was 2 for 12 from behind the arc, which is, you know, crazy for somebody like Lonzo. Not that he's a terrible three-point shooter, but just the volume that he's shooting these threes at. And, I mean, he was open for a lot of them, but so many of his rebounds, like so many times on his threes, it was one of those situations where you're in little bitty ball and you always say follow your shot, you know, back in the day. So many of his rebounds would bounce like kind of right back to him. But the defender would get there before he did because he didn't like step up a little. And he started realizing it, actually. It's like got to the point where, like, midway through the it happened like two or three times, and then midway through the Mavs game, he actually started following his shots, which I thought, like, even after he shot him, which is usually a bad sign because it usually means the player thinks he's going to miss. And he was missing. But, yeah, no, it was just an observation I had. It was something I kind of got aggravated with Lonzo about. But I do want your take on Lonzo for this game because this was his best game as a Pelican. He had 7 turnovers, but the rest of the numbers were definitely Pelicans highs for him. So what do you think about Lonzo's game individually last night?
I think it was better. I mean, I think people are going off the deep end hating on Lonzo at this point. I will admit that he has not been what I thought he would be. We had talked about him not being a pure point guard before the season even started, so that's not a surprise to me. But it's been a surprise how much that he isn't that. And I think a lot of it relates to his ability to get to the rim and to be a threat there. We've talked about this ad nauseum, so this is not new. But that's a real problem when you're trying to run an offense. Now, with that said, I thought today, or I should say yesterday, I thought that some of that was better. I thought he was attacking the rim. And even if the results weren't great, I remember one time he threw his body into some sort of shot blocker. Or shot blocker might be a loose term for whoever the Phoenix defender was. But he threw his body into a big. And the guy went into, he went through 2 or 3 feet the other way. Lonzo took a shot. And I mean, it didn't even touch the rim. It went off the backboard. But it actually wound up being a dunk because Jackson Hayes was on the other side of the rim. So that said, I'm a process over results guy for younger players, so I like the ideas, and I think the execution comes over time. So with that said, I like that. I like that Gentry said he should stop taking step-back threes. He should not be taking step-back threes early in the shot clock. I think he actually made one yesterday, but he shouldn't be. He's not the level of shooter that should be doing that. And I think part of the problem is
there are better plays.
There are better plays, and I think it's bailing him out of doing what he should be doing, which is trying to get into the paint some way, somehow, even if he's not trying to shoot. I think teams are aware of the fact that he doesn't want to shoot, and I think that they treat him as such. And I think – but you have to get there. You have to at least try to get there, and that should be your initial, I guess – that should be what you're trying to do pretty much almost every possession. And then there are certain times, if you're a great shooter, like if Damian Lillard walks up and they're all dropping back waiting for that, I mean, Damian Lillard can take that shot all day. I mean, that's a different player. I just think with Lonzo, it's a process over results thing. I thought it was a little better last night. I think that people are a little bit too low on him right now. I think they've kind of overcorrected, but he has some real things to work on. That's a thing.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of the players have real things to work on. One thing that needed to be worked on last night was the bench for the Pelicans. It was very weak. The starters were actually all, you know, pretty solid last night, in my opinion, at least pretty solid. I would say they were all pretty good, especially, you know, when it counted. I shouldn't say when it counted. But in the fourth quarter, and for the most part throughout the game, the starters all played pretty well. But the bench was really non-existent. Now, the Pelicans have had certain players coming from the bench have these, you know, nice nights. Like Frank Jackson's had a couple of really good games where he's gotten hot. Josh Hart, depending on if he comes off the bench or not, has had a good season for the most part, of course. Kenrich Williams, he's actually mainly played well when he's been a starter. But my point is that they've had individual performances that have been pretty solid off the bench, you know, Redick some nights. What was up with last night? I mean, where were the players on the bench?
That's a great question. They weren't there. I mean, the starters were basically all within a few points of even on plus and minus. And not that that's the perfect measure, but if you're trying to look, like, you don't have to explain it. Just when they were on the court, was the team doing well? And last night, that really was more the starters than it was the bench. And I think, I would say that our bench has a lot of players you really can't count on at this point, given our depth issues. So, I mean, look at it. So, Kenrich is, we've talked about Kenrich. He's usually starting, or he has been starting more recently. He wasn't last night. I don't know if that'll change since Lonzo's back now. And maybe Lonzo will stay in the starting lineup with Redick. Maybe Kenrich will replace Redick. But so, Kenrich is really best when he's paired with other people who are going to score a lot. And so in some ways, I think it'd be a more natural fit to put him with the starting unit and let him do the little things while the other guys score and stuff. I would say, I mean, Josh Hart. So Josh Hart had a stretch during that, and I'm not hating on Hart because Hart is very often a positive player for us. But he missed. He had, let's see, he had 7 threes in a span of about 9 minutes in the third quarter. He missed 6 of them, and look, sometimes those are shots that he would make. He probably took a couple shots he shouldn't have taken. But I would say, like, so besides him, so again, we're going down the list here. So Kenrich should be starting probably at this point. Hart, you know, he'll have nights where he's off. He was off. That's okay. Melly, I struggle with Melly, man. I don't mean that to be negative. He had a couple positive plays, including steals. But I think Melly hurts us a lot because he's just so, I would say, as a team defender, like, even if he knows how to position himself, he's just so slow, man. And people say that he's quicker than I give him credit for. I don't know that he is. I think there are times where he'll have a possession here and there where he's moving well, but he's just in a perimeter-oriented game, I think he struggles. And I think especially even if you have him near the rim, he's not contesting shots. And so what is he really doing out there? I mean, he's really just out there to shoot threes. That's basically it. I think you can get that at other positions, but you can also get more from the other facets of the game. And then we'll go down to Nikhil, because I had a love affair with talking about how good Nikhil was this summer, and he's just been struggling. I mean, he's a rookie, but he's been really struggling. So you really can't count on him for a whole lot at this point. And then Frank Jackson, who's more or less been out of the lineup. I mean, so what is there to get excited about right now? Not a lot. Yeah. And
each one more.
Even play. It's not, and I don't hate any of those players. I'm not saying, if you look at that line, those lineups, I mean, there's just not a lot of scoring talent there. I mean,
no, we just need Favors and Zion back. I mean, that's pretty much what it comes down to, because that pushes everybody else kind of back into their roles where they're supposed to be. So it's not as simple as just saying, oh, Zion and Favors come back. So no, it puts everybody, puts all the other puzzle pieces in place when they're there, like they were projected to be going in. And so, I mean, especially Favors. Look, I get Zion's going to be out a while, you know, January, February, who knows? But Favors had his mother pass. It's an unfortunate situation, of course. But you know, I'm hoping that he'll be able to return to play, you know, sometime this week. I know that part of the problem, or I shouldn't say problem, because it's obviously a tragic death in his family and it's his mother. Part of the reason that he's missed so many games because of this personal issue was because I know that the funeral is in Atlanta. And I think that a lot of people don't realize when a player has a death in the family, when an athlete has death in the family, they always just kind of assume like, oh, well, okay, you can go to the funeral in New Orleans and then be back, you know, in the next. No, because the player always has to make travel arrangement. And usually the athlete is also probably, for lack of better words, the richest person in the family. So usually they have a massive influence on the funeral, if that makes sense. And they need to be there basically to finance everything and to help coordinate that kind of stuff. Whole point of all this is that while I'm not surprised Favors has missed a lot of basketball here, and it's of course unfortunate, I am hoping that he'll return soon, because I really think that puts Jackson Hayes back I think he's going to be great in a kind of a change of pace bench role at center.
I agree. I think that's a more natural role, and I think that was a well-explained thing, because it's not that any of the individual players on the bench are bad. It's just they're being placed in roles where they really don't, they're not really meant to be. And I think when you have two people back, or even just one person back, it's amazing what happens when people slide into roles that they're meant to occupy. I really do think this. I think they need to move Kenrich to the starting lineup. I really think it'll be better. And I do think that JJ would be better on the bench, because JJ's been lights out from three. But
he has been hot lately.
At the same time, man, when one of the problems with playing JJ is that when he is on defense, man, there's just not that much you can do to hide him. I mean, he's not particularly fast. He's not tall enough, and he's still probably a net positive on the floor, I think, in many ways. But I think he's better. I think the starting lineup is better optimized with Kenrich out there right now, and I think that would be the move that I would make.
J- J- I like that you're making a stand and saying a move, because that's rare for a lot of people to do. And I like that you're saying, okay, this guy needs to be starting, this guy needs to be benched. It's very clear cut analysis there. I just interesting thing I just thought about JJ. Is he the only player that, well, you know how we acquired all these new players? I mean, I think only, I forgot the stat there, but I think only eight of our, what are we rostering,
Well,
like
it's 15 total, but then you had the three
15?
two-way
I
players.
think it was six. I think it was six out of 15 players were Pelicans last year. So we obviously acquired like nine or 10 different players here. And out of all of them, is JJ Redick the only one kind of playing like we expected him to? And I'm not saying good or bad. I'm just saying he's the only one who hasn't surprised us in either a good way or a
You
bad
talking
way.
about the
Like,
new
right,
guys?
like we kind of, yeah, out of all the new players, yes. Is JJ the only one playing like we kind of thought he would?
That's a hard
Seems
question.
like it to me, at least.
I would say, okay, so let's go down the list, right? So JJ, Drew, we already covered all those, and then Drew's not new.
Hart has been better than I expected. Zion has not been expected because he's been hurt. So, that's been a surprise. And then you have,
Hayes is probably
gosh,
slightly outperformed. I would say Hayes is
Hayes.
slightly outperformed.
I would say,
He's not much better than I thought he would be. I think he's, as an energy guy, he's
he's
doing what he
playing a
would
lot
do. I think his
more.
positioning has been better than I expected on defense, but his rebounding has been an issue on defense as well. All right, so Josh Hart, I agree, has been slightly better than I expected. Lonzo has been slightly
But this is
worse.
not the role.
No.
Yeah, this is not the role that I expected Hayes to
No.
be in. Favors honestly been, a disappointment so far for a variety of different reasons. And then I don't know. It just seems to me like Redick was, whether it's good or bad, whether they outperformed or underperforming for whatever reason, or just being a different role or different player than we thought. It seems like JJ Redick is the only one who kind of came in and he's kind of giving us exactly what we expected
Well,
of him.
let me do one caveat.
Yeah, go
I
ahead.
think you're right. I would say that part of it, though, is he's probably not gonna shoot 47% from three the rest of the year, but it's actually possible. He's done it before, so it's not impossible, but I agree. I think his overall effect has been pretty much exactly what we thought, and I think you nailed it. I hadn't thought of it that way before.
Yeah, and it's a good thing. I mean, we had good expectations, but not great expectations for JJ, and he's been a good player for us. It's good that we have him on the team. Let's talk big picture, and then we'll give our final shout outs. Big picture, real quick. The Pelicans are 6-16 right now, and that coveted eighth seed still is in possession of the Sun. The Suns are still in possession of that, and it seems like they've had the eighth seed for, gosh, like a month now. But they are only 10-11, so that's another reason why last night's game was so kind of devastating that we couldn't close it out. Because then you're looking at, then we're 7-15, which, obviously doesn't sound great on the surface. But then, of course, the Suns are 10-12, and now it's 6-16 versus 10-11. It's a game difference, of course, but the Pelicans, the fact of the matter, the Pelicans are almost at the bottom of the Western Conference standings. Let me get your opinion. Do you think it's time to call this now with the Zion news? Now the fact that we dropped this game to the Suns. Now the fact that we have lost seven straight. We're 6-16. With all of the things that happened in the last week, Michael, are you willing to concede this as a rebuilding year and put that balancing scale more on development yet, or are you still competing for the eighth seed?
I'm really close to shifting. I'm still probably 5 games away. I'd say,
That's exact.
really?
That's exactly. I wasn't gonna say five. I was a little more. I was gonna say by the next episode, if we keep losing, I was gonna say the next episode, I'm probably gonna call
Yeah,
it.
it's
You know
pretty
what I'm
close. I
saying?
think it's pretty close. I think the time is nearing where it's just gonna make more sense. I
Yeah.
wrote an article about it today, and I don't know if I put a number on it, but 5 is the right. 3 to 5, whatever. I mean, yours might be 3, it might be 5. I think we're pretty close.
Well, it depends on if we drop
Yeah,
all
well, sure,
five
yeah.
or if we
Right.
win.
And oddly, it's probably going to be right around the time when Zion's, projected to be back or whatever. So, yeah, I'm cool with that.
According to you.
That's true.
I'm just checking. Anyway, let's give a few shout outs before we leave the show today. I'll go first, and we thought it was going to be a cool idea to give positive shout outs for each show to end the show on a good note. Don't have to be basketball related here, but mine is this week. I want to give a shout out to Joel Myers, who on the Dallas Mavericks game, I believe it was Tuesday night, he was not it was on TNT, and he was not supposed to call that game. But the lead anchor, I guess, Kevin Harlan, had lost his voice. And they immediately went to Joel, who was just sitting in the stands, I believe, and just watching the game as a fan. They went up to him and said, "Hey, you know, Kevin Harlan lost his voice." And he immediately said, "I'll fill in." He didn't even let him ask a question. He just said, "I'll fill in." And it's not, I'm not just giving him a shout out for that. I was going to give him a shout out just because I just think that Joel Myers is honestly incredible. I think he's so great at his job, and the way that he was able to call that game for an entirely different network than he's normally with, like different commentators. I think it was Reggie Miller he was with. His knowledge of the league, the whole league in general, is really admirable. And his lack of bias on that national scale when he's working with the TNT crew, I mean, gosh, he was really just the star of the show, I thought, and he was just a fill-in. You know what I'm saying? So, I don't know. I definitely want to give props to Joel Myers. The Pelicans, I think, you might disagree. You watch all the games here. But I think the Pelicans have a great one in Joel Myers.
No, I agree. Joel's pretty great. I actually met him. I don't do a lot of on-site coverage, and I've been doing this for, whatever, 10 years, mostly from the comfort of my own couch. But I went like to maybe two or three games, and I met him, I think, twice. And the second time he remembered me, and I'm a peon, so the fact that he remembered me was pretty cool because he meets just a bazillion people and very sharp, very professional, smooth voice. Yeah, I don't know why that's that was an odd order of things, but yeah, it's good.
Some people have aggravating voices.
Yeah, I agree. No, Joel's great, and I have a shout out too. It kind of very different in its tone, but let's talk about Wool Sox for a second, because for many years I didn't know, like, people had talked about Wool Sox, and I didn't buy it. I didn't have any interest in buying Wool Sox. We live in Louisiana, but before I went to Spain, I got a bazillion wool socks because I knew how cold it was going to be. And let me tell you something. Those things, dude, like, I hate that I'm getting so excited about wool socks, because I feel like this is the most excited I've been talking about anything in maybe, like, a couple weeks.
Well, we're in the midst of a 7-game losing streak.
Yeah, but I have a life, too. And, like, what I'm wanting to talk about is wool socks. But, so, dude, you put wool
really
socks
not
on, man, and, like, your world just changed. Like, you're just, like, you're... I just don't know how to explain it. It's like one of those things where I don't even know where to start. But I just, you're warm, like, all the time, as I guess that's the whole point of wearing wool. I don't know. I'm just a fan, man. I don't, like, it's really shitty analysis. And, I mean, I've been cursing a lot this episode. I'm sorry. But wool socks are great. You should buy them. If you don't have them, go to your local, like, store nearby. Buy some nice wool socks. I promise you will not be disappointed.
Yeah. So the cool thing about wool socks is that when you wear them, you're obviously not wearing them as shorts, right? Because the whole point is to be warm. You can wear them under, you know, pants, and nobody's going to know. Like, if you work at an office or something like that, nobody's really going to know, as long as they're, like, brown, you know, and not just, like, basic white. Nobody's really going to know that you're not wearing dress socks for your job, you know? I remember back in when we were young in high school, and I'd wear jeans, and I still do it sometimes to this day. Like, when I wear jeans or boots or whatever, I will still wear soccer socks when it's really cold out. What I'll do is I'll put my regular sock on.
I remember this.
And then what I'll do is I still do it. I'll put my regular sock on, and then I'll put soccer socks over my regular sock. So I'm not only my double layer in my feet, but the soccer sock goes all the way up to your knee pretty much. And
Nick, you're wearing,
you know,
stockings.
The shin guard's not really. Yeah. Well, yeah, but it's under pants. So it's under pants, so nobody knows you're even wearing them. And your legs are always warm. And it's, you know, I'm talking the. You know, us Louisiana guys, you know, we're going to freak out when it's, you know, in the 40s, unlike a lot of people up north. So anytime it hits the 40s, you know, I'm wearing soccer socks over my socks, and nobody's really going to tell me otherwise. And then the shin guards aren't even that noticeable.
Yeah. And you know, the Oakdale people that are listening, which is nobody besides your wife, is probably going to be looking at your socks now. But
Well, they don't play soccer here, so they don't have soccer socks. So,
all right, one more thing.
So, but yeah,
one more thing
noticed.
Before we
go
close,
ahead.
I want to get your opinion because after one of the recent losses, I think it was the Mavs. I think maybe Mason tweeted something about. Do you have anything you're angry about? And I started tweeting a bunch of random things because I was just being stupid that night. And I asked him a question that's really near and dear to my heart. I said, "Do you like olive, or why are olives on so many things? They're not good." And I want to get your take. Do you like olives?
Wait, are you team?
No, I'm team
olive,
against
are you
olives,
against...
obviously.
Okay.
What kind of person do you think I am?
Honestly, I don't think I don't have a massive preference either way, but I will agree. I'm gonna go with you because I'm gonna go ahead and agree. I don't get the obsession about olives. Yeah. I don't get. Not there's like an obsession. I don't get why people even eat them. I don't know. It's not that I hate them. I just don't think they're necessary, I guess. So I guess I'm on team no olive because I would never have I had a meal and be like, you know what would be great with this? Some olives. Right. I've never said that in my life, never thought about it in my life. Again, if you force me to eat an olive, I wouldn't like spit it out. It's okay. So I'm not like anti-olive, but I'm definitely anti, olives are necessary on anything.
I think that what they do is they ruin perfectly good things. I think the problem with an olive is it's something that when you put it in something else, it takes over. It's an alpha dog, and it might not be the right alpha dog for your meal. And I think that's the problem is it can't just be there and be a role player. Like it has to be the center of everything. And that's my problem with it. It's like this is perfect analogy for right now. Not perfect. I hope it's good. I think that the olive is like the Carmelo Anthony of NBA offenses. I do.
Right. So when you stick them into the Trailblazers, you're changing your whole team dynamic.
Yeah, and maybe this would have been a better thing maybe a year ago because I think Melo is supposed to be playing pretty well right now. But that's the problem with olives in my mind.
Yeah, they definitely. Yeah, I guess I was wrong to say that I didn't really notice them. I mean, they're definitely noticeable taste. I don't really care for them, I guess is the best way to say it. It reminds me, and now we're in a food discussion here, but it reminds me of when, like, you know how there's certain meals that people eat and they need to be like covered in butter and like salt to be like
right,
good.
Right, because they're
like,
not
decent.
Good.
Like, so I know I'm going to get a lot of flack on this for all the Pella fans and NOLA people listening. But crab is one
crab?
Of these things where it's like, yeah, crab. And it's just like, I eat crab and like people dip crab and, you know, whatever. And, you know, sometimes crab served in, sauteed crab, it's served in butter and that stuff. Yeah, it's good then. But me eating just a normal crab without any seasoning or anything like that or butter, I'm just like, this doesn't really taste like
anything.
What
do
you
eat without any seasoning or butter, period?
Well, that's a good that's
crab.
Fair,
I cannot stand with you on this, but yeah,
the stuff that needs to be coated in other stuff, I should say,
yes,
is probably a little overrated. And whereas I'm going to take the olive step even further, if you are team olive, and you need olives on something, because olives are so overpowering. The thing you're eating is probably not that good. You know what I'm saying?
I agree.
I guess
with
that was
kind of
my whole point.
I didn't love my analogy. Going back, I think it's not as good. But I do think the olives are an alpha scorer on the wrong team. And I will stick with that. So maybe not Melo, but maybe someone else. And that's the last thing I have to say about all this.
That is the last thing we have to say. So that's going to
wrap
up
olives.
This week's food podcast. I mean, Pelicans podcast here. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Pelicans cast, the official Pelicans podcast for hoopball.com. You can check hoopball.com for any of your NBA and fantasy basketball needs. Please give us a 5-star rating if you decently enjoyed this show today on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast provider is. That is it. We'll see you next Friday.
All right, stop.
This has been a HoopBall presentation.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.